on recording over a listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please, stay tuned.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now, the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Jimmy Durante starting us off on Saturday morning. It's the 20-something or other of August, the 28th. You know, in Elaine Stritch's One Woman show on Broadway at Liberty, she tells this story that on opening night of the Broadway play, Member of the Wedding, all the actors, Julie Harris and Ethel Waters, all adults, apprehensive, nervous, opening night on Broadway, all the tension. And 7-year-old Brandon DeWilde, the little boy, and it goes running down the hall backstage, yelling in everybody's dressing room, it's time, it's time, unafraid. And you know, sometimes on Saturday mornings, as I'm pulling my thoughts together, I'm thinking, Brandon, come in and shout, it's time, get me ready for all of this. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is Any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM. And it is the 28th, and the talk is, of course, pandemic talk. I have about 1,000 things to say about the pandemic, as I do every week. A couple of interesting and not so happy items. Do you know what age category is the most resistant to getting the vaccinations? I have the charts. I get them daily, and I examine them thoroughly. 85 and older, my peers, they're at 50%. The 21-year-olds are in the 60% now, and this is New York City. The other concern is I've talked to a couple of people working in hospitals, and they've told me that they are preparing in the next 2 weeks for a surge coinciding with back to school. Does that mean kids? It's possible. It's what's happening down in Louisiana, as reported in today's paper. Children getting the Delta variant, unvaccinated, contaminated from unvaccinated elders who have ventured out. Here's an interesting item, and the consequence of it. Five men who are conservative radio hosts, all insistent anti-vaccination people, have died. Dick Farrell, Florida, died August 4th. He was a Newsmax anchor, 65 years old. Ted Tucker, 60 years old, mocked those who got vaccinated. He was in Oklahoma, died August 4th. Jimmy DeYoung, from Christian radio program, accused the vaccination of being government, a means of government control. He died on August 15th. Phil Valentine, on something called Keptic, August 8th, he died. And Hank Benier from WNDB in Florida is now hospitalized and accused the government of being Nazi-like for with their mandates, not their mandates, but their use of the vaccinations. Dick Farrell called Fauci a power-tripping, lying freak. Jimmy DeYoung said Pfizer will make women sterile. The world government is using vaccines to centralize power. And what's interesting is that someone said to me, are you happy about their deaths, when I was discussing it? I don't celebrate the deaths of people. I had hoped that when they were, that they would have survived, and told their many listeners that they were wrong about the vaccination, that had they gotten vaccinated, they might not have been so sick. Delta Airlines has increased insurance for all unvaccinated staff, $200 a month increase because of the high costs they have incurred with staff people who are COVID patients. And that may be another industry impact or after effect of the pandemic. Private companies with insurance plans might be raising the monthly imposition on workers who are unvaccinated, because that increases the possibility they're having to have very expensive medical care. Five-Dade County, that's Miami, Florida, Five-Dade County cops died last week from COVID, and three dozen were out, not working because of it. And you know what? I get all these internet stories sent to me. It's such sloppy journalism. Those stories about the men dying, all of which I got on different internet reports, the journalism is just atrocious. They forgot something that we learned in basic journalism, the five W's and an H, who, where, what, when, why, and how. They don't give hometowns. They don't give the names of the stations. They're full of opinions, but not of information. Sloppy journalism. Well, that's the pandemic report, which is depressing, and the emails keep coming in to me about the conspiracy of the vaccinations. But you know what's nice? Frank Sinatra singing a Duke Ellington song, and that just changes the mood completely, doesn't it? Frank, give us a mood indigo, will you?
Been blue Well, you've had that mood indigo, that feeling go stealing down to my shoes while I sit and sigh. Go long blues, always get that mood indigo since my baby said goodbye. In the evening when the lights are low, I'm so lonely I could cry. 'Cause there's nobody who cares about me. I'm just a soul who's bluer than blue can be. When I get that mood indigo, I could lay me down and die. You ain't been blue. No, 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 no. You ain't never been blue till you've had that mood indigo, that feeling that goes stealing down, way down to my shoes. Why? Sit around and sigh. Go long blue.
One of the things you want to know about music at mid-century in America, in which Sinatra was a dominant force, that an arranger-conductor named Nelson Riddle was introduced to Sinatra. I don't know who made that historic connection, but he revitalized Sinatra's career with arrangements, and that CD, that song from the album In the Wee Small Hours, was just an immediate and enormous hit and has become the Nelson Riddle Sinatra teaming has become standard. It's become immortalized as an example of the best of the music of that period. And interesting enough, years later, the very talented, versatile Linda Ronstadt heard, she did not grow up with that, but she heard that and said, "Who arranged these?" And somebody gave her the name Nelson Riddle, and she said, "Is he still around? Is he still alive?" And he was, and they got together, and then she made a couple of albums, which are standard Ronstadt albums. So the name Nelson Riddle, for you younger folks, and everybody in the world is younger than me, so I can say that without fear of contradiction, that I know there are two of you listening that are not, and you'll let me know. And I know who you are because you tell me. So that Nelson Riddle is an important part of the musical history of our listening pleasure. A lot of politics happening this week. It happens every week, but this is kind of obtrusive. And Kathy Hochul, the new governor of New York, about 2 weeks ago, I think 1 out of 20 people could identify who she is, which reminded me of the story. I may have said this last week. Somebody was once suggested as vice president candidate, and Sumwag said, nobody knows your name. And he said, nominate me for vice president and everybody will know my name. Well, we all know who Kathy Hochul is. And she picked her lieutenant governor, the very affable Brian Benjamin, about whom I knew very little other than the fact that he was the senator from state senator from Harlem. Not nearly as in evidence as his predecessor, Keith Wright, who was a force in Albany. But Brian Benjamin seems quite affable. But the political implications of her naming an African-American man as her lieutenant governor and probably her partner when she runs for re-election will certainly have an impact on the decisions that Letitia James might make. Letitia James might decide to stay as attorney general, which I'm a big admirer of Letitia James, and I'm very happy with her as attorney general and would be quite content if she stayed in that, maybe someday running for governor. But the implications of this, of her naming Brian Benjamin, about racial politics and gender politics and the upstate downstate team, the black and white team, all of that. She's a little more conservative. He's a little more progressive. That seems to be the political aspects of the new team that's running in Albany. And I suspect that Brian Benjamin will be much more ubiquitous than she was as lieutenant governor, because he will have direct impact with the black and brown communities. He's quite engaging. I don't know much about his politics. Now, down in Georgia, as you know, Senator Warnock, the first African-American elected to that state since post-Civil War days, was only for a two-year term. He was filling out was that Jeff Sessions? No, Jeff Sessions, Alabama. Somebody's term. Raphael Warnock was filling it out. So he's up for re-election. And what's happened this week, Herschel Walker announced as a possible Republican candidate in the Republican primary. And Herschel Walker was a Heisman All-American Heisman Trophy winner, pro football player, and has been a supporter of Donald Trump. He's an African-American male who, in one of those early football leagues before Walker went to the NFL, was on a team that Trump was part owner. And they have known each other all these years. And Trump has given him the stamp of approval in the primary, wanting an African-American to run against Raphael Warnock, who is African-American, to split the black vote, I'm sure. And he made the one statement that Trump provides to a candidate. He called Herschel Walker loyal. That's all you have to do is be loyal to Trump. You don't have to have a political opinion on anything. I've seen Walker interviewed over the years. He's a very engaging, young man. He's not so young anymore. He's in his late 50s. But he had some mental health problems many years ago. And that will come out in a campaign. And I hope he can avert, it would be nice if he could avoid all that. I think he's being pushed by Trump so that there's a prominent black figure to challenge Warnock. And also, which would have an impact. Now, the governorship campaign is going to be Brian Kemp against Stacey Abrams, most likely. Now, that's an interesting situation, because Trump loathes Kemp, because Kemp thought that an honest election was more important than Trump being declared the winner in Georgia. And that gives him the label of disloyal to Trump. So I'm sure Trump will try to have a primary opponent to undo Kemp, which will split the Republican Party and hopefully ignite Stacey Abrams, one of the most astute political people in America today, that she will become governor of Georgia. Let us hope on that. So it's a lot happening in Georgia that's kind of fascinating to watch. Makes me a little nervous. In California, the recall of Gavin Newsom is well underway. And if you understand California politics, if a majority of people vote for him to be recalled on the ballot, are the alternatives. And while 49% of the people might vote to keep Newsom in office as governor of California, it will only take 20. There are about 50 people running for governor in California, and it will take 20% will get somebody in. So Newsom could get 49% of approval and lose out to somebody who gets 20% of the governor's vote, if you can follow that. And the leading alternative is a conservative radio host named Larry Elder, who calls climate change a hoax and is against minimum wage. So that, welcome to California. My final political note is a question. Wasn't Trump supposed to be back in the White House by August 6th, and then it was August 13th? Remember, and I hear that now it's going to be in October. He's starting to resemble the character based on William Jennings Bryant in the play Inherit the Wind, a bellowing man who's subtitled Echoes of Voices Past. I have a feeling that Trump is going to eventually become a voice not to be heard. We'll see. Let's have some music. Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Keep on keeping on.
got two emails right away. One said we're off the air. I put on my radio. I could hear Gladys Knight. If you can hear me, I need at least three people to email me right now and say you're on the air. But this is BAI, you know. We've been known to go off the air. A vote of confidence, so I don't babble on. My stage name could be Thunder in an Empty Forest. I got a wonderful email from my friend Larry Belling when I responding to my mention that older people are the least likely to get vaccinations in New York City. He has a new theory to persuade older people to get the vaccine, to have Pfizer putting Viagra in some of its vaccine shots, and they can have a week-long erection. Well, are we on? Somebody tell me, are we on? I'm at drothenberg at fortunesociety.org. Can you hear me? If I don't get three emails in the next minute, then I know I'm off. And I'll stop talking. Well, Barbara can hear me, and I know she's on Riverside Drive. Thank you. All right, so I'll continue. We're listener sponsored. All right, the calls are coming in. Thank you. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people. I'm on. It's what is known as the BAI experience. We're listener sponsored, believe it or not. Thank you, guest who's coming on at 9 o'clock, Michelle Weinstein. Yes, you particularly will be glad that I'm still on, because I'm looking forward to talk to you about your, not only your book, which is so good, Gone by Morning, but the background story that you shared with me when I started making inquiry about the person that wrote this book, Gone by Morning. We're listener sponsored. Did you ever hear that? And last week we had James Lapine on as a guest, and we still have some. We have copies of his book that are available. It is one of the most, for anyone who's interested in the theater, one of the best books by a person in the theater. I would rank it along with Morsort's Act Two. Putting it together, which is how James Lapine, the director and book writer of three shows with Sondheim, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, and Passion. This is about how that putting it together is how he is a relative novice in the theater, teamed up with Stephen Sondheim and create, it's about the creation of Sunday in the Park with George. And I found it an excellent book. His interviews 30 years later with Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters and with a lot with Sondheim and with people in the Schubert organization about all the ingredients that makes a show go on. Now, I was an early viewer of Sunday in Park with George and thought it was absolutely ecstatically. I've just went crazy over it and surprised to hear in reading this book that of all the problems and doubts and fears that they had and that people were walking out. Well, that's the history of greatness, I guess. So, putting it together is the book, and I urge you to consider supporting BAI by getting a copy of it. If you, it's $50 to BAI. If you email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org, give your phone number, and then I will call you over the weekend and you'll get a copy of Putting It Together. The other book, which we still have a few copies of, Yosef Salaam's incredible book about his Better Not Bitter, which is about his unparalleled journey as a member of a group of Harlem youths once called the Central Park Five, now called the Exonerated Five. The historic implications of his story because of Trump's early allegations and championing a death penalty for the unjudged boys before the trial, and the racism and the failure of the criminal justice system to be responsible, responding more to the hysterics of the headlines than to the facts on hand. Yosef Salaam's book is a must. And if you want to support BAI with a $40 gift, we will send you a copy. All you have to do is email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. And
you'll get a copy.
I give you a phone number. It would help if he gave your address also. And that's a way of supporting us and keeping us afloat. I'm impressed. All of you, thank you for telling me that I'm on the air. One person, obviously her radio failed. But Roberta and Deb and Marjorie and Angela and Elise and Barbara, Tom and all of you who have Marjorie and all of you, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you're paying close attention. Vanessa, you too. Bruce? Helen, you also. Stephen in Chicago. Listening, well, that you, Stephen, you're probably on the internet. That doesn't count. All right. At this point, David Rothenberg does an essay called Out on a Limb. And since you're hearing me, I'm gonna present it to you now. Let me take a little bit of water first. Isn't this an adventure that you don't even know that one person's radio fails or they're in a block of some sort? And you wonder if you're on the air, but this is very Hamish radio. It's fascinating. I don't know if there's another radio station where somebody on the air says, hi, everybody. Am I on? Am I off? And suddenly everybody starts sending in emails to tell me that I'm here. Thank you for being with me this morning. I feel less alone. All right. Here's the essay. It's Out on a Limb. There was a moment last week when I turned off the news, defiantly closing off from CNN, New York One, and especially Fox News. It had become like a calamitous symphonic crescendo, as if the world and its reporters were determined to overwhelm me. There were pictures of Afghanistanians running towards departing planes, reports of the COVID surge as the Delta variant spreads amidst protests against masks and vaccinations, fires in the West, floods in Tennessee and North Carolina, Trump holding a rally, got booed, Andrew Cuomo having a less than generous or gracious departure in Albany, continued reports of anti-Asian assaults, cops on trial for shooting black youths, Henri rushing up the East Coast with gleeful guidance from meteorologists. And it was all coming to me in my bedroom where the television set is, dutifully giving reports of fresh disasters. I suddenly saw myself as that screaming character in Edvard Munch's Portrait. And in the background, Tony Newley was singing, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. I had to limit my TV viewing to Golden Girl reruns and Yankee games to ward off the madness. I put on some soothing CDs, Johnny Hartman, Blossom Dearie, Peggy Lee. Then I took a walk. I watched children in a playground who were letting out high-pitched sounds of excitement and innocence. I looked at a couple huddled at an outdoor cafe, and I watched some dogs discover each other, you know, smelling and sniffing. And I suddenly realized there was a world going on that seemed unconnected, oblivious to the avalanche of futility being reported on the home screen. So as I tried to plow through this contradiction, it occurred to me that one of the main downsides of the pandemic for me, and perhaps for you, was that I had become more of an observer of life than a participant. I don't go to the castle anymore for the meetings on Thursdays. I miss my retirement assignment at Fortune Society in Long Island City, which is composed of giving visitors a tour, showing them the education and vocational programs, and then meeting with the advocacy folks on political strategy, and then with the arts program people where formerly incarcerated men and women have found their voice and have discovered what it was like to be heard. All of this has been replaced by Zoom gatherings, and all the people I've grown to know and care about and to love appear on my laptop the size of a Benjamin Franklin stamp. This WBAI airing this morning is from a mini studio, very mini, and the studio is my desk at home. I no longer go to Atlantic Avenue. I can roll out of bed to talk to you. For the first months of the pandemic, I viewed movies on Netflix, saw 5 years of The Crown in 2 weeks on a screen the size of a manila envelope, and I kept watching until my back screamed for mercy. Recently, movie theaters reopened, and I resumed that near-religious experience that I began when I was 3 years old, and I watched Shirley Temple in The Littlest Rebel, and I discovered that there was a world outside of Richfield Park, New Jersey. I have a few friends who have retreated from the city, living isolated lives, protected from the city. And in phone conversations, I've discovered that their isolation from the city and the virus, that there's a desperation, a near a nihilistic view of the world as they interpret the news to me. Obviously glued to the TV and the internet, they sound as if the world is swallowing them up as they reside in islands of comfort. I'm not providing breaking news when I tell you that the world has always known dominant, mean-spirited people, but they weren't in our homes every day and every hour. The information tsunami has its down drawbacks, and the pandemic has led us to a greater dependence on it. As television overwhelms people of my generation, the internet is the ubiquitous intruder for millions of younger Americans. One of the great ironies of our time is that Trump has convinced a healthy chunk of the Vox Populi that the mainstream media is fake news, and they've responded by soaking up any internet, Twitter, Facebook opinion that has no accountability. The phrase fact-checking is unknown to them. So we have stories like a DC pizza parlor backed by Hillary Clinton, which serves as a front for sex slavery of children, which resulted, as you may recall, in a shootout at that pizza parlor. Then the absurd story that Biden has not been in the White House, the president's residence taken over by the military awaiting Trump's return, and that Biden is holding up in a Tyler Perry studio in Atlanta created to look like the White House. And then that which hits us every day, the misinformation about vaccinations. I receive a dozen links a day, WBAI listeners mostly insisting that I hear this, an Idaho doctor, or other reports from nowhere land about deaths from the vaccine. And all figures about the virus deaths are inflated. Dr. Fauci is consistently demonized, and most significantly reminding me that the pharmaceutical companies have spread the lies for profits. And I've yet heard hear a similar allegation served up about Viagra. And then it's time to turn off the television set and the computer and take another walk. If the virus doesn't kill me, or if I'm not mowed down by a bike or a scooter, I might be doomed by the factual reports on CNN and the fearful fantasies on the internet. The pandemic has dramatically altered our lives, and it takes conscious effort to not let it destroy the psyche. I've placed a mask on my soul to keep out the conspiratorial negativity. I implore folks, no more links about vaccine myths. But some seem determined to share their pathology. But I've discovered a defense, a Siegfried line of protection. It's called the delete button. One of the most important discoveries since penicillin. The world has never had a shortage of bad news, and the media, real and fake, is almost orgiastically stimulated by smothering me in all of it. All my life, I've marched and I protested against evil and bigotry. I know it's there. But sometimes I just want to go out and watch the kids in the playground. You know what? They're as real as the violent seditionist who climbed the Capitol building on January 6th. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And here's Donny Hathaway.
You go. sings. Never have a problem we can't overcome, 'cause you'll always be the one. Never thought I'd be so happy. Loving you has made me feel so fine. I can see my friends turn green with envy. Every time I tell them I'm so glad.
I came late to Donny Hathaway. I knew him years ago as a singing partner on a few hit songs with Roberta Flack. But then I found this CD, and he's very special, isn't he? That song was written by a man named William Peterkin. Didn't know who that was. Donny Hathaway. I was challenged. There was no shootout at the pizza parlor in D.C. Was it that the man was caught with weapons out front threatening? There wasn't a shootout, Pastor. And here's a philosophical. Thank you, Warren. He asks, if a tree falls in the forest and no one emails to David to tell him, does it make a sound? Interesting. Here's some people that have been in the news in the last week. Sirhan Sirhan, 72, made parole with the support, two of the Robert Kennedy's children, in support of his making parole. One of the things I've always found about this assassination is that there's never seemed to be studies to that I know of to determine what was the cause. There was a glib mention in one of the stories about his being up for parole that he opposed Robert Kennedy being pro-Israel. Everybody was pro-Israel. Except for those that are pro-Palestinian, don't want to get... I take that back. Not everyone is pro-Israel. I never felt that there was a clarity on on what Saran Saran did. He says now that he has no memory of the shooting. Interesting. Another person in the news is a little baby was born on a plane out of Afghanistan, and they've named her Reach because the C-17 had a logo on it that the name of the plane is Reach. And so this little girl is now and forever known as Reach. She's lucky she could have been named C-17. And Lenny Dykstra is back in the news. He was a great, one of those energetic Met ball players that everybody liked because of his tenacity. He's obviously a jerk. He ended up in jail for some bankruptcy fraud, and then there was car theft charge on him, and then flashing women that he would meet through Craigslist. He's suing a lawyer. Last year, he was suing Ron Darling because Darling wrote a memoir in which he accused or stated that Dykstra hurled racist taunts at a Boston pitcher named Dennis Boyd during the 1986 World Series. So Lenny Dykstra, who was a sports hero, has been in a continual state of disarray, broke in lawsuits, scaring women with sexual displays, a disappointment. Not all right. I want to tell you about a book that I read. We're going to have the guest in 2 weeks. His name is Josh Melville. It's one of those stories that in my life, there are things that haunt you. And I may have told the story. And Josh was a guest a couple of years ago. He'll be a guest in 2 weeks because his book, America Time Bomb, is published. But we have copies of it already, and I'm making it available to BAI listeners. As you may or may not know, I was one of the observers during the inmate uprising of Attica in 1971. And forever after, come September, I'm called upon to speak at different forums, recalling that historic event and the implications of it. It must have been in the late 70s, early 80s. I was talking to a group in Manhattan, and the front row was a little boy. He turned out to be a teenager. I thought he was 12. He turned out to be 18. And when I was finished and asked for questions, the hand went up, and this boy said, "What do you think about a man who tried to change the world and forgot his son in the process?" And I said, "You are?" And he said, "Josh Melville." My father was Sam Melville. Sam Melville was a weatherman who had been in his protests against the war and against America, ended up in Attica and was literally assassinated in the yard after the takeover. I didn't know what to say to Josh. We talked afterwards. This young boy, his girlfriend, we sat and talked for a few minutes. And then I didn't hear from him. And I told that story often about all the rippling implications of a historic event like Attica and what this boy was haunted by, that he lost his father, who he apparently really never knew. And then about 2.5 years ago, I got a phone call. David Rothenberg, yes. Josh Melville. And I said, "Oh my goodness, how are you? Where are you?" A man in his 50s, a businessman in LA with three grown children. He was coming east because one of his daughters was going to college in New York and he was going to escort her. And he wanted to meet with me. And we met. I think I invited him to be on BAI. I'm not sure. I'll have to ask him. I have the memory ain't great these days. So, he told me he was writing a book about his search for his father and what he had found out about not only his relationship with his father and who his father was and what his father's protests were against America, but how he was truly assassinated. And he tried to track down the man who killed him. And it is a book of inordinate power. It's coming out next month. I'm one of the people on the back jacket. Here's what I'm quoted as saying, and I'll read you a couple of others. Josh Melville makes a strong argument that the pen is mightier than the sword. As a son longing to understand his father's death at Attica, his story is the stuff of grand opera and Greek tragedy. As detective and historian, he has delivered a mesmerizing tale, insisting that America look at itself. That's from me. Bill Ayers, who was a protester of note in that period, writes, with the imaginative power of a novelist, the tenacity of an investigative reporter, and the seriousness of purpose of a historian, Josh Melville has produced a remarkable double memoir. First, the story of his dad, Sam, murdered by an agent of the state at the age of 37 during the notorious uprising at Attica Prison. And second, the pursuit of his father's legacy and his own truth. In the end, Sam Melville got the historian he deserves, the dazzling son he called Jocko. I almost cry when I think about this story. And the Attica thing keeps coming back at me. I've been doing a lot of pre-Attica memorial interviews in the last couple of weeks, and I'm just shocked at how emotional I get in reliving that time. In any event, Josh Melville's book is available to BAI listeners. A $50 gift to our station will get you a copy. The books are in-house. I've gotten them already. Email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give your phone number, and I'll call you back. It is a significant book. I call it to your attention. And what more appropriate than Judy Collins singing Bread and Roses?
As we go marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we bother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead, go crying through our singing, their ancient call for bread. Small heart and love and beauty, their tragic
political sound of Judy Collins, or the social conscious sound of Judy Collins. Somebody sent me a clip, and I didn't delete it, of elephants, of a baby elephant. It is so joyous. I've always loved elephants. And in this link, elephants are fascinating. You see the guy working with the elephant playing at some musical instrument, and the elephant standing behind him tapping his foot rhythmically. Then you see the elephant with his trunk takes the hat off the man and puts it on his own head. And then he's behind a fence, and he climbs over the fence and hugs his trainer. And I've told this story before, but I have to tell it again, having seen this beautiful little film about elephants, baby elephants. And that was, I was at a conference, and they showed film clips of this, of a man in Africa who was known as a elephant whisperer, and that he was in this brought to this town where a herd of elephants outside the community were coming in at night and creating a problem with the noise and messing things up. And so he went out into the area where the elephants hung out outside of the town, a few miles away. And for several weeks, every day, he would go and sit and talk with the elephants and whisper to them and chat with them and befriend them. And that went on for months and months. And then at night, he would go back to his little house in the community. And after about 6 months, one night in the house, he had a heart attack and he died. And the next day, the elephants that had not been back in the community since he had been meeting with them returned to the town quietly and surrounded the house where the elephant whisperer lived, and sat there silently for an overnight period, and then got up and went back to their area. And they showed us movies, film clips of this. It's one of the most extraordinary things that I've ever seen. We'll play something from a Broadway musical. It's from the Rink. Two women, I wonder if they ever had good careers, Cheetah Rivera and Liza Minnelli. They sing a song called The Apple Doesn't Fall. And when that's over, we'll be talking to Michelle Weinstadt Miller about her book, Gone by Morning. Cheetah, Liza, sing to us.
We're not so very different, you know.
Please.
Well, think about it.
I hate Mr. Whipple.
God, me too. I hate growing older.
Boy, am I with you.
You don't have to be a professor to see the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
I hate washing dishes. All that grease.
Ugh, I hate Mrs. Carlucci. May she rest in peace. There's more than a few things on which we agree. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. For 9 months,
what?
I carried you under my.
If ever apart.
No wonder
I can be annoying, scream and fight.
Sometimes I'm no lady.
Yeah, you got that right.
So the saying is true. Look at you, look at me. The apple doesn't fall very far.
Hey, are you two okay?
We're fabulous.
Come on down.
I'll catch you ladies later.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Me, I like to stroke some big guy's chest.
Especially Italian.
Oh, mama, they're the best. You don't need a sheepskin from Harvard to see the apple doesn't fall.
Like a guy who'll scratch my back.
Try a little lower.
Scratch my back.
The apple doesn't fall very far from a tree.
For 9 months. At least I was never ignored.
Oh, for 9 months I gave you free room and board.
Your top's mine.
Thank you. I know I shouldn't say this.
Oh, be my guest.
We're not so very different.
Now I'm real depressed. Well, you're both.
Two pros, Cheetah Rivera, Liza Minnelli, from the Broadway musical The Brink. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM. Is Michelle Weinstein-Miller with us?
I am.
You are. You see, Michelle, not being in the studio, I have to rely on the computer to know who is where. Welcome. Your book, well, Gone by Morning. It sizzles. You can almost smell New York while you're reading it. It was a great read for me because I love stories that capture the city. And I'm so impressed that the blurb on the front is by one of my favorite crime authors of all time, Lawrence Block, who describes it as a writer of passion and substance. And that's what's in Gone by Morning. Let me just set it up. It's a hot summer day. A bomb goes off. It reminded me of that thing in the Port Authority. Remember when the bomb went off? And then your story begins. And your protagonists are three women. And I don't know how much you want to tell about it, but these women are so New York-y. And I'm wondering, it's a daughter, a mother, and a grandmother. Which one are you in them? And are you part of this story? Is your story reflective in Gone by Morning?
Well, thank you, David, for having me. I'm really happy to be here. And I just want to say that Lawrence Block has been a mentor of mine for many years. An overnight success has taken decades to get here. And the quote is incomplete. What Lawrence Block says is that I've lived more lives than a cat, which makes me a writer of substance. And that's true. So there's a little bit of me in all of these characters. You know, one of the women is a 68-year-old previously incarcerated person who has, you know, lived a life of redemption and lives a normal life and is getting pulled backwards into danger and crime and is trying to do anything to not get pulled back there. So I'm a previously incarcerated woman who I often find that theme in my fiction. The idea that I have done all I've done over decades to build a life worth living and a life where I'm of service to others, and that, you know, my record of incarceration or my prior life of addiction would somehow pull me back against my power. Now,
let me just say, Michelle, that I know you as an attorney. And when I read the book, I said her description of the underbelly of New York life is so astute that that's not a turn an attorney's perspective. That's the perspective of someone who's been there.
Right. So I graduated NYU Law School at 22 years old and had a history of addiction at the time and quickly became just developed a devastating addiction to cocaine and heroin in my 20s. And so I was arrested under the Rockefeller law after just a few years out of law school and faced 15 to life in prison, a case that I fought for 4 years, not plea bargaining because the best plea bargain they offered me was 8 1/3 to 24. So I didn't feel that that was an option. And so I ended up winning that case after, you know, because the police didn't have a warrant, not through any kind of innocence on my part. But I ended up being convicted of a felony due to another case that I was arrested on because, as I said, you know, I was suffering from addiction, from substance abuse. So I did spend some months on Rikers Island, and that's another thing that's very funny about my fiction that I maybe it's not funny, but the books that I write, and I sometimes notice this in retrospect because when we write, we're not always clear what we're going to write. You know, it just sort of comes out on the paper. Every book that I've written has at least one incarceration scene. And, you know, what that showed me is that the trauma just is, you know, I was only on Rikers for a few months. So I'm not like, the folks who have spent years and years in solitary or decades of their life, you know, wasted in a prison environment. But the trauma is long lasting or forever. And so I seem to be always sort of grappling with it, at least as a piece of what I write. So I've had a wonderful life since I, quote unquote, as we say, beat the case, you know, since I, you know.
And beat the addiction.
I beat the addiction. Yeah, I'm 32 years clean. And I always put that first because I could, if I pick up, you know, all bets are off. And I, you know, don't feel very close to picking up. I've been living this way and, you know, a life where I am hopefully a blessing in the lives of others. And which helps to, you know, helps me to feel purposeful and grateful. I just sent my twins off to college. They're doing wonderfully. So I have all these wonderful, you know, I had the opportunity because I won that case to build a second life, you know. And so I was disbarred because I had a felony conviction. So I was automatically disbarred. And it took me many years to get back my license. From what I understand, from what I've been told, I'm the first attorney in New York convicted of a drug felony who got their license back. But what I, you know, one of the things that I could really safely say is that in those 15 years that I wasn't in prison, I was of service in my community. Not the first couple of years when I was a methadonian on 125th Street methadone program, but once I left the addiction alone, I worked for 6 administrations of the state, 3 city administrations, 3 state administrations. I've worked in affordable housing. I've worked in family court, protecting children. I was the chief ethics prosecutor with the Conflicts of Interest Board for 5 years. And so some might find that a little bit ironic that I have found myself being ethics officer or ethics prosecutor on numerous occasions in my career. And in fact, I prosecuted Charles Hines, was one of the things that I did for abuse of his office when he was campaigning. So I've done wonderful things. I've been of service in my community. I have never decided to, you know, go for the money and not be of service to my community. And frankly, you know, the deep state is the only one that would have me because the prejudice against people with criminal justice history is so debilitating to the career that even I was convicted in the 80s, even now I have to talk about my drug use in my 20s when I go to an interview. So it is nice.
But,
you know, it's
better now. But Michelle, what's interesting is with all of that, you practice as an attorney, but also as a writer, that you're a published author. And Emily, one of the three women in your book, works for the city. And while reading that, I said, boy, does she know City Hall, the author.
Right.
Because you've used all of these experiences to create a novel about New York, which is rich and reflects all that. But you're not doing that. You said that I'm curious because you said that I'm fascinated by the whole process of writing or of creating. And that you're not you said when you get to the paper, you're not sure where it's going, but it's there in your head.
Right. I mean, I usually
you have the plot outline, but you don't. I suspect.
Right. I tend to have the beginning, middle, and end, and how, and like many novelists, how I'm going to get from point A to point B can be a mystery, and so. Yeah, it's nice. Like, I feel better if I have an outline that includes just about everything. But I don't necessarily, and even the outline itself is not something that I can consciously say. I don't ever consciously say, let me write about somebody being threatened with prison. Let me write about, you know, Rikers Island. That sort of comes to me as I'm going along, and always seems to come out. Even when I wrote a book about the zombie apocalypse, I ended up having somebody in jail, not planned, but
they end up there. But you know, your women in Gone by Morning, for example, Kat, who's an older woman and a former madam. I know her. I've met her at Fortune Society. I've met women who are not Kat per se. But some of the fears that you express that she has, what she goes through, the fear that her past is going to constantly come back and nip at her. I've seen that and I know that. And the same with Kat's the grandmother, Lauren's the mother, Emily's the daughter. I'm not going to give too much of the plot away. They're all related, but there's a lot of estrangement. There's a lot of getting to know each other in later years. And Lauren is the most enigmatic, but probably she's a recovering addict, so closer to you than the other two women, is she not?
Right. Well, I think there's a little of me in each of them, but Lauren is a family. Well, she was a family court attorney, and now she's a divorce lawyer. So yes, she's somebody who's had a career trajectory like mine, and is also very cautious about. Letting anything shady jeopardize the stability that she's found in her life. She's also married to somebody with multiple sclerosis, which my father had, so I got a little bit of that out. And Emily is the deputy press officer in her 20s at City Hall. And so I do, you know, I have been in city and state government forever. I was. And so there's a lot of, you know, what she goes through working with the various city agencies and with the mayor that are similar.
Well,
to
you know, I've hung out at City Hall during a couple of administrations, so I recognize the truth of it. How do you write? Do you pencil and paper, computer, typewriter?
No,
the morning or at night? How?
Okay. Well, I am a morning person, but most of my novels have been written on the New York City subway. And so the pandemic has upended that. And I actually haven't.
How do you mean you've written on the subway? You have a pencil and paper and a paper?
No, I have a teeny little laptop. My first novel I wrote in longhand on the subway and then transposed it to a computer. But as technology is going along, I have a little 2-pound laptop that I take with me when I'm commuting, and so I'm always trying to get it.
Where do you commute from? What part of you live
in
Manhattan?
Now I'm not doing that
because of the pandemic. But pre-pandemic,
yeah.
Were you living in Manhattan?
I live in Washington Heights, and I worked right down the block from City Hall.
Aren't you distracted on the subway, your concentration, or does the noise of New York inspire you as you write about New York?
Well, you know, only when the breakdancers, you know, flip too close to my laptop and I start getting nervous. And so, you know, that could be a little distracting, but generally speaking, not. And I have to remind myself not to tell people to be quiet, that it's not my living room. And, you know, so in the last year or so, I had started to bring some sort of music and headphones, but I didn't do that for most of the time, but I was finding that I was giving people dirty looks when they made too much noise. So I decided I better get some music and not be the annoying woman on the train.
So the next time I see someone concentrating with a laptop, I should tell everybody, be still, that there's a genius at work creating a novel about I find that fascinating. And I would think that writing about New York, you get something from that. Do you walk the streets and get inspired by this city? Because the city seems to be a character in your, certainly in Gone by Morning, the city is a character in your book.
I don't really have to do that. I mean, it is important to be observing what's going on around you so that you have things to write about. I can't be completely in my head thinking about myself, but I do have to be aware of what's going on. I think just knowing a lot of people, you know, hearing people's stories throughout the years, like what you said about, probably somebody who was a madam or a sex worker and they're on the other side of that. And so I've known a lot of people like that. So it's endless stories out there in New York. And so I've been here since I was a child. I've always been in New York. So New York is a good, you know, an easy story for me.
So now you're a working attorney. How does this affect you of being an attorney, your past? Does it help or does it not help? And how does that get in the way of your writing? Two questions.
Lately it does. Fortune Society the hours can be very long. We're all very dedicated to what we do, and the hours can be a little overwhelming. So I haven't, in the pandemic, I haven't quite figured out how to balance my life out. And you know, we writers have to market as well.
We had, Michelle, established that you're an attorney at the Fortune Society. I was saving that for last.
Oh,
so you're working,
I'm sorry,
as an attorney at Fortune, you're working with formerly incarcerated people.
Yes, and that was a complete coincidence or synchronicity, depending on how you look at it, that the very, you know, week or month that I was, you know, selling this novel, Crooked Lane, I also received a call from the Fortune Society to see if I would like to work with them. It's been hugely rewarding. But I, you know, just to backtrack on your question, it has been an interesting thing being an attorney with a criminal justice history. You know, it has been, you know, there was a time like this time around, I'm using the name Michelle Weinstadt Miller, but I always used Michelle W. Miller before that because I was always trying to separate out that career from my story, which is something that I feel very grateful that at Fortune Society, my story can be a part of me. I don't have to separate out the two parts of myself. And what happened, though, over the years is that when Google digitalized criminal records, I could no longer keep the fact of my past secret. Right. And of course, I could never when I was applying for jobs. But in any event, so I always have to figure out how to tell my story to a potential employer if I'm.
Well, your past was an asset at the Fortune Society, wasn't it?
I think my past was an asset in many areas. You know, I think I have a much broader understanding of the many folks that live in the city. So when I was in family court, dealing with abuse and neglect and parental rights, I was dealing with our own population, my own population, people who many of them were struggling with drug addiction. So I was able to understand much more readily and be able to give a chance to somebody to get it together when another attorney would just be, you know, completely clueless about it. So I'm grateful that I've been able to do that. And I think also, you know, dealing, you know, with the Conflicts of Interest Board, I, you know, understand, I think, more readily what a lot, you know, what some city employees are going through when they get in trouble. So I think that, you know, just the breadth of my experience has been a benefit. And I certainly hope so.
And raising twin boys, that's quite a production unto itself.
Yes. I'm not too happy with the empty nest, frankly.
Are they going off to college this year?
They just went last week.
Where are they gone? The same school?
They're roommates. Yeah, they're in Goucher College in Maryland.
They're roommates. That's interesting. As twins, they didn't want to get away from each other, huh?
No, I don't think they really wanted to get away from us even. I mean, most people are incredulous when I say that. But my husband, who's a high school chemistry teacher, and I and the boys, we all worked in the same space at home for a year and a half during the pandemic. And I really enjoyed it. And I think that it wasn't half bad. It was the upside of a very devastating pandemic was to be around my teenage sons quite a bit.
Interesting. The book is Gone by Morning. The author is Michelle Weinstein Miller, and I loved it. We had never talked until that I know of until after I read the book, and I want to know who you were. And I read a lot of crime fiction, and I love the New York scene. That's one why I've always been a Lawrence Block fan. What's his character's name? It's been so long.
Matthew Sutter.
Yeah. He had a bar that he used to go to at 57th and 8th. And I used to wander looking for it because his characters were so rich. And you capture that same kind, that tempo of New York in Gone by Morning. So I compliment you for your achievement.
Thank you.
Not only for your book, but for the whole direction of your life. And thank you so much for being with us this morning, Michelle Weinstein Miller. And the book is Gone by Morning. Someone said you were a little shy about talking. I thought you overcame it quickly and effectively.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. And thank you. And I'm just very happy to be
I'm going to tell people how they can get a copy of the book, but first we'll hear, and saying goodbye, we'll hear some from Frank Sinatra. He'll do a little Rodgers and Hart for you.
Thank you.
Look at yourself. If you had a sense of humor, you would laugh to beat the band. And look at yourself. Do you still believe the rumor that romance is simply grand? Since you took it right on the chin, you have lost that bright toothpaste grin. My mental state is all a jumble. I sit around and sadly mumble. Fools rush in, so here I am. Very glad to be unhappy. I can't win, but here I am. More than glad to be unhappy. Unrequited love's a bore, and I've got it pretty bad. But for someone you adore,
It's a pleasure to be sad, like a straying baby lamb, with no mammy and no pappy. I'm so unhappy, but oh, so
Murray Hart's lyrics were just devastating, weren't they? That's Rodgers and Hart. Before Rodgers and Hammerstein, there was Rodgers and Hart. Very different kind of lyrics. Oscar Hammerstein had, "Oh, what a beautiful morning, what a beautiful day." Larry Hart had, "I'm very glad to be unhappy." I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Copies of Gone by Morning by Michelle Weinstadt Miller, available to WBAI listeners to support us and her. If you email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org, $50 for a copy of the book, and that we'd be making a tax-deductible gift to us. Email me with your phone number on it, and I'll get back to you. drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. The book is called Gone by Morning, Michelle Weinstadt Miller. Interesting story, is it not? I read the book, and then I found out she had been hired by the Fortune Society, hadn't met her, and then we've started talking. I found her background fascinating, her story fascinating. The Arts Corner. Remember when I used to do that, books, movies, and plays? I went to the theater this week. I went to a movie this week. I read two books this week. Let's do the book first. I'll do one of the books. The second book, I haven't prepared my review yet. Joyce Carol Oates is both exasperating and compelling with her new novel, Breathe, published by Echo. She pulls the reader in to a time and place that we hope to avoid, but she doesn't let go. Breathe is her protagonist's plea to her dying husband, and it's also Michaela's surrealistic response. Dr. Gerard McManus, her husband, a Harvard graduate, has taken temporary residence in a New Mexico research institution when his ignored physical limitations evolve into a death watch for his devoted mate, Michaelis. And while her cries of breathe are inflicted on her husband, it's also the silent survival cry as she navigates hospitals, the strange to her Southwest ambiance, and the fears of the unknown. In Breathe, Joyce Carol Oates shares Michaela's private moments, her thoughts, her dreams, her fantasies, all of which you suspect you have no right to be near. It's as if you're a literary peeping Tom. But Joyce Carol Oates' great gift is to keep the reader close, involved, but nearly embarrassed because of the intimacy. The loss of the other calls for ritual formalities, but Miss Oates is always the explorer of the inner journey, the unprocessed turmoil. If not soothing, it is certainly stimulating. Breathe is a reminder of Joyce Carol Oates' singular place in the pantheon of American fiction writers. At the theater, I made my first visit to a Broadway theater this week for the first time in 18 months. Cautiously, I ventured to the August Wilson Theater with the vaccination card had to be presented to 18 different people there, mask coverings necessary to attend Antoinette Chinoy Nwandu's complicated play, Passover. It has opened after successful runs with the Chicago Steppenwolf Theater and the Intimate Box and the top of Lincoln Center, earning respectable reviews, which I suspect prompted the switch to the Broadway showing. and also feel that a smaller venue would have served the play Passover much better, which, as reported, has echoes of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Here in Passover, two youths, Moses and Keith, dream and they plot to get off the block. That's the similarity to Godot. They are black youths burdened with all the impositions imposed on them from forces that trace back to slavery and the pharaohs. They are a reflection of plantations and pyramids of the past, and Danya Taymor's staging is insistent and compelling. Mr. Nawando has shaped two vivid characters, brought vividly to life by the elasticity and energy of the two actors, John Michael Hill and Namir Smallwood. But I thought the playwright lessened the power of Passover by moving into the past. The notion of these boys getting off the block contains a multitude of dramatic possibilities and inherently has a historic content. But one play can't be called upon to be a cavalcade of social injustice and inflicted limitations. The playwright's ambition is admirable, but the drama is rerouted in its historic reflections. Passover has a powerful premise and a pair of engaging young actors, but the play fails to ignite sufficiently. And at the visit to the theater, I went to the Quad to see a documentary called On Broadway, which ends pre-pandemic with a series of interviews and stories about people in the theater and about the glory of Broadway and the magic and you see the stars are interviewed and scenes are showed and excitement is revealed. And you know what got to me emotionally? The footage of the crowds on Times Square moving about in 2018, oblivious to the future, unaware that this was, they took so for granted, they're just moving about, walking around Times Square on their way to whatever, to a play, to a movie, just to strain their necks and see what's going on, just being around the excitement of Times Square. And I looked at that and I said, did we have any idea? Do we know what we have when we have it? I've started avoiding crowds at Times Square because it's gotten so crowded. And I just long to walk right through the middle of those people. I wanted, watching the movie on Broadway, I wanted to hear the score, the overture of a big musical. I wanted to hear people buzzing as the curtain went up. I wanted all of that, but the crowd, the people, that's what it was, the people. I got nostalgic for the people, the anonymous masses, if you will. The movie's called On Broadway. It's at the Quad Theater on 13th Street. I hope somebody calls in and gets a copy of Michelle Weinstein's Miller's book. It's worth your read and it's worth supporting WBAI. You can do that as Gladys Knight and Marvin Hamlisch and the Pips all get together. And you might remember Streisand and Redford in this movie, The Way We Were.
Hey, you know, everybody's talking about the good old days, right? Everybody, the good old days, the good old days. Well, let's talk about the good old days. Come to think of it, as bad as we think they are, these will become the good old days for our children. But why don't we try to remember that kind of September when life was slow and oh, so mellow. Try to remember. And if you remember, then follow. Oh, why does it seem that the past is always better? We look back and we think the winters were warmer, the grass was greener, the skies were bluer, and smiles were bright. Can it be that it was all so simple then? Or has time rewritten every line? And if we had the chance to do it all again, tell me, would we? Could we? Memories light the corners of my mind. Misty watercolor memories of the way we were. Scattered pictures of the smiles we left behind, smiles we gave to one another for the way we were. And if we had the chance to do it all again, tell me, would we? To remember, we simply choose to forget. So, with the laughter, we will remember. Whenever we remember. Remember, the way we were.
I think it was in the late 60s that I started getting angry when people at a concert would start jumping up and applauding in the middle of a number. And my feeling was the audience is getting in the way of the artist. It's about the artist. Let them sing. And then I was at a Gladys Knight concert, and guess who leapt to his feet and started screaming in the middle of a number? It was contagious. You couldn't not. That was the only time. Mostly I got annoyed. But not with Gladys Knight. I had to join in. Let me tell you about what's available, the books that we have, the way you can support us, listener-sponsored. Aren't we annoying, constantly asking you to support us? But that's how we stay on. Three books that I've been telling, you know, it's four now. American Tie Bomb, Joshua Melville's book. He'll be my guest 2 weeks from today. Attica, Sam Melville, and a Son's Search for His Answers. Let me tell you, this book is dynamite. Heather Thompson, who was won the Pulitzer Prize for her Attica book, wrote, a vital read for this moment. America Time Bomb is a most beautiful memoir. And even while the conclusion that it draws may like the tumultuous decades that it covers generate some debate, they will no doubt give readers much to think on for a long time to come. It's one of the important reads that you can have. American Time Bomber Joshua Melville, about the search for his father who was killed in Attica in the yard. A $50 gift to BAI gets you a copy of the book. We're at, you email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give you a phone number and I'll call you. There's James Lapine's Putting It Together, now on the bestseller list. The author and the book writer and director of the Pulitzer Prize winning Sunday in the Park with George. He's written a book that is, for theater historians, one of the best. He talks with Sondheim and Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters and himself about putting this play together, Putting It Together, by James Lapine. He was our guest last week. $50. Email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Our guest today, Michelle Weinstadt Miller, the book Gone by Morning. You heard her. It's a treasure of a story of oozing with New York, and her own journey, so fascinating. And our guest of many weeks ago, Yosef Salaam, whose story, Better Not Bitter. But gee, we have good books. Yosef Salaam was one of the exonerated five, originally known as the Central Park Five. I'm very proud of the collection, the diversity of these books, and the interviews that have been part of it. There is a CD that's available for two CDs I'm going to tell you about that are available for $30. My interview with Marvin Miller, who next week, a week after Labor Day, will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. My interview with him may have been the last interview he did before he passed away. I am going up to Cooperstown to be there when Marvin's name is inducted into the Hall of Fame, and have been told that my hour-long interview with him will be in the collection of goods that are going into the Hall of Fame. That CD with Marvin Miller is available for $30. Also, the interview with Yosef Salaam, the man who wrote Better Not Bitter, the man who was one of the Central Park Five, now known as the Exonerated Five, that's on a separate CD along with an interview with Alabama former governor Don Siegelman, who was falsely in prison, my interpretation, and was a guest on this program. And that CD with the two separate interviews also available for $30. So there's a potpourri of things that you can, premiums, if you will, that will enrich and make your life more stimulating, more interesting, and at the same time, keep us jabbering away on listener-sponsored WBAI. After we hear from Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack, I'm going to raise a question or two that be curious about your thoughts on the subject. That's what is known as a teaser. So here's Donny and Roberta Flack, and then I'm going to raise a question for you to consider. Donny, Roberta.
Where is the love?
All it says on the CD is that that song was written by McDonald and Salter. No first names. Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack. The question I wanted to ask you, I was watching Colbert one night, which I don't do often, and he told one of his riffs, and he said something bold. Don't even remember what it was. And then he looked at me and said, I know what you're thinking, and then proceeded to answer what he thought I was thinking, which had nothing to do with what I was thinking. And shortly after, the next day I was reading a book and one of the characters said to the other, I know what you're thinking, and then proceeded to act on it. And I realized that, do you know how many times in our lives somebody says, I know what you're thinking, and they have no idea? One of the great mistakes that we make in life is that we presume what's going on in somebody else's head, and what we think they're thinking is what we are, because we are the result of our own life experiences, not the other person's. Oh, sometimes we may know them well enough to, and they may be, it may be a predictable situation, but in most cases, we don't know people. We don't know what's in their minds necessarily. And I've sort of kept it in my head over the last few months, the number of times I've been in a situation where somebody says, yeah, I know what you're thinking, or yeah, I know. And they don't know what I'm thinking. Usually I'm thinking, how do I get out of here? I think it's a trap in our society that we act on imagined thinking of other people and then have a behavior response to incorrect assumptions. Does that make any sense? Any thoughts on the subject? I have to give you an update on AT&T also. I've told the story several times, but it always needs repeating because I got another bill from them. AT&T has provided me with phone service for 105 years. And several months ago, they announced that they were no longer covering people in Manhattan, and I had to find another outlet. And after much jockeying about, I got Spectrum and told AT&T, and Spectrum began the process of, through computers, getting all my information from AT&T. And they told me it would take about 10 days for it to be hooked up. In the meantime, AT&T cut me off. I had no phone service at home. And me without a cell phone, that was isolation. So I called the main number at AT&T and said, can I have another 10 days? Please, you've cut me off. You're no longer serving this arena, or you're not going to in a couple of months. And I've gotten Spectrum as you've requested me to, but I need another 10 days. And the man, after several minutes, said, we have no record of you. I didn't exist for AT&T. And I said to him, but you've been billing me for over 30 years and I've paid every month. He said, that may be true, but we have no record of you. And I thought that, well, I'll live without a phone for 10 days. And then I got a bill in the mail from AT&T for the 2 weeks in which they didn't cover me for $28. I wasn't going to pay that. It was fraud. It was the
conglomerate beating up on the little guy. And so I announced proudly to everyone that I spoke to, I'm not paying AT&T. And my friend Richard, also an attorney, said, and if you don't pay it, they can affect your credit rating. That they had the power. They could do something devious, immoral, illegal, and then affect my... So I sent the check, finally, for $28. And then I got another. For late payment, I owe $6.48. And I thought, well, for that, I'll let them ruin my credit rating. And so now I have a second announcement from them. This is the second warning that I owe $6.48. My friend, the attorney, says, oh, pay it. I don't know if I'm going to. I don't know if I want to pay that $6.48 to AT&T. They don't need it. I'm not sure if I need it. But I guess you have to pick your battles. Judy Collins, your biggest hit and the only hit song that Stephen Sondheim ever wrote that made the charts. There's a combination. And we're now about to hear it.
Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. clouds.
That should pick you up from A Little Night Music, Judy Collins singing Sondheim. I'll be with you on Monday at 10, next Saturday at 8. Jenny Burton takes us out, and thank you for being with me this morning.
To 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Any Saturday with David Rothenberg came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is On the Count at 10 a.m. Please stay tuned.
Greetings. Delegate elections are underway, and you are invited to leave a voicemail on 510-993-0320 with your questions and comments for candidates running to represent you on the local station board. We will invite all candidates to respond to your questions and produce an on-air election forum. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information about the delegate election process. And remember to vote before 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on October 15th.
Tune in to WBAI Playhouse Saturday, August 28th at 8 p.m. for Betrayed by journalist and playwright George Packer.
Wherever I went, I was defending the Americans and strongly saying America was here to make a change.
And now?
I have my doubts.
What is there to doubt?
Packer's play is about three Iraqi civilians working as translators for American forces in Iraq. As tensions mount on both sides, they find themselves with nowhere to turn.
Even in the morning when I go out from my house, we're thinking that maybe I am not coming back.
The interviews I did with Iraqi interpreters working with American soldiers and officials in Iraq and around the Middle East were so disturbing and moving and just compelling to me that I couldn't get them out of my head. These voices of mainly young men and women telling me their story, really their life story, in a series of conversations I did with them in early 2007, seemed to spill over beyond the bounds of journalism.
That's George Packer. Tune in for his play, Betrayed, developed with New York's Culture Project, Saturday, 8 p.m. on WBAI Playhouse, right here on WBAI New York.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan. On WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in.